Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We didn't get to our brief today about what happened in history, so we're going to make a very quick run through history rather than make a long one as we usually do at the top of the hour, just letting you know what happened today in history. It was interesting. This was, for me, a blues aficionado. This is a day that John Lee Hooker died in 2001, one of my favorite blues guitarists. He was 83, played from when he was a teenager until the day he died, and was an amazing human being. But this was also the day that the trial of the Haymarket began in Chicago in 1886. It began May Day, the workers' holiday, where some people say these were trumped-up charges against workers that began a trial that lives on in our history. This is also a day before that, in 1877, another group of workers called the Molly Maguires were hanged in Schuylkill County, in Carbon County, Pennsylvania, who went on strike and were hung because they went on strike and then defended themselves against the Pinkertons who attacked. This was the day in 1923 that Marcus Garvey was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Many people say this is one of the very first trials where the federal government used charges of mail to defraud people. They said many people argue these charges were political. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He had led a movement that was very powerful in the African-American community and was put in prison at this day. In 1968, a demonstration that I walked through as well, was part of, when Native Americans from the Poor People's Campaign demonstrated at the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. on this day in 1968. And this is a day that many of us will never forget. This is the day that James E. Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner were killed. The three civil rights workers. One man in 1994 was later convicted of participating in that death. Edgar Ray Kill and everyone else walked away. Nobody ever served time for that. And it was one of over 25 murders that took place that year in the civil rights movement, but it's one that grabbed America's conscience the most. That was today in 1968. That they were murdered. This was also the day that after the trial and conviction of Muhammad Ali, that he gave his famous interview and speech about why he refused to serve in Vietnam. That occurred in this day. So that's today in history. And now we're going to look at today in the world with our national news roundtable. We have with us in studio Marta Mossberg, who is columnist for the Baltimore Sun and the Frederick News Post. Marta, good to have you back in again.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Margaret Flowers is in the studio, co-director of its reconomy.us and co-host of the radio show Clearing the Fog. Good to have you back, Margaret.
Thank you. Good morning.
And joining us by phone from New York is Imara Jones, economic justice contributor for Colorlines.com, who has served previously in the Clinton White House. And Imara, good to have you back with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Better than Paula Deen, I suspect.
Yeah. I suspect. we can do a show about that too as well. So we are going to cover a number of areas today. The NSA scandal, immigration, what's happening in Syria and Afghanistan, and what our foreign policy should be. So, and we want you to join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages, which I'll be checking in a moment, and please tweet us at Mark Steiner with your thoughts and ideas on these issues. And we'll start with the one that with the NSA. I think that that's still kind of roiling through, and new things are rolling out of it every day. And it's interesting. This is something that you see a majority of Americans. Well, polls have been different. But the majority of Americans seem to say, "Look, whatever you have to do to protect your liberty, you have to do because I'm innocent and it's not going to hurt me." But you have activists from the right and the left and others who are saying, wait, we need to look at what's happening here because this is a dangerous coming together of the federal government and our largest corporations who can find information about us and kind of go through our phone records, and we'll get into the specifics of that. But what are your takes on this, Marta?
Well, it's very troubling to me. I feel like the government has vast powers that it uses to collect data on many citizens, American citizens, in addition to foreign nationals, whether it's inadvertently or purposely. I mean, the newest information that came out this morning from The Guardian was that, it showed two documents on what the NSA is supposed to do when it's undergoing its surveillance activities. And they did not give me a lot of confidence that we are not being watched, because the data can be held for about 5 years, I guess, according to these documents, even if it's an American citizen. So there's just a vast network of either, you know, both through the government and through the private sector monitoring our daily activities. And it just, I just feel like we have no privacy anymore.
And we also just found out, Margaret Flowers, that Skype news broke this morning that Skype is now right. in.
Project Chess or something.
Yes, that's
called?
Project Chess. Where
they joined PRISM in 2011.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Glenn Ford had a piece this week in Black Agenda Report saying that under Presidents Bush and Obama, we now have the complete infrastructure in place to have, you know, a full police state. They have, you know, they can surveil everything. And we had Thomas Drake on our program this Monday to talk about this, as well as a gentleman, Fred Brampman, who broke the secret war on Cambodia and Laos back in 1969. And you know, there's this whole myth of national security, and people support this because they've bought into this myth. The propaganda has worked to make people be afraid that we have to have this huge security state in place, and there's no control. It's in the hands of private corporations who can use it however they see fit, and it essentially makes democracy impossible and the rule of law impossible in this country because Congress members are being listened to, judges can be listened to, and so everybody knows that what they say and do goes on record, and so that people are going to be much more restricted and limited in, you know, in what they have the courage to say and do. So this really affects all of us, and we need to recognize that.
Imara?
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, you know, the joke was Big Brother is watching you, and it appeared in commercials, but it turns out it's not such a joke, especially when it comes to people of color, as I wrote about earlier this week. When you look at the particular programs and the way that they were designed to capture particular information, because blacks and Latinos use social media more than whites because they rely more on, because of the greater digital divide, rely more on these types of services to keep in contact with friends and families, disproportionately their information will be caught up in the government's dragnet in a way that I think is surprising when you look at it. And of course, secondly, there are 40 million immigrants in this country, the highest in the nation's history, and the president assures, and the documents seem to suggest that these programs are mostly interested in communications between outside of the country and between Americans and others, which means that the communications of 40 million immigrants are also subject to disproportionate monitoring by the government simply for keeping in contact with friends and family from doing routine things. And so I think for a lot of reasons, these programs are worrying, and I think that one of the things that people don't understand because of how fast the technology has progressed is that eavesdropping is actually less what the government is interested in than mapping behavior and relationships. That is to say that one of the whole points of eavesdropping used to be to know who you were talking to and what those people were saying so that they could then try to figure out exactly the web of suspected activity. Now they don't actually have to eavesdrop because of metadata, as they say, this large hoovering of massive amounts of information. I think the estimate by Michael Binney, who worked at the NSA, was that 20 trillion individual pieces of information. What they can then do is to be far more intrusive than just eavesdropping on a phone call. They can map your all of your contacts, your entire social network, what you do, when you do, how you do, and never have to listen to a phone call. And that's far more disturbing, I think, than, you know, someone listening into when you ordered pizza. And so I think that the American people should, you know, we have to have a much broader conversation about what's going on, because the metadata, this mapping of your entire life without ever having to listen to a phone call, is really disturbing.
And one of the things that I'd like to pick up on here, then we'll go to the phones, and Bryce, you're the first caller up at 410-319-8888. We're going to come to that call, but throw this question out. One of the things that is kind of very disturbing that people like Bob McChesney, who was on the show on Monday, talked about and other people have talked about, is that there is no oversight, because so much of this is being done by private corporations at the behest of the government, also using information from those corporations. And then this information that they get, as I think one of the things Amara wrote in his article, was that all these corporations can then also track for their own profit everything you buy and everything you do, so that, especially immigrants, how do they use services, where do they buy things? That's all part of this data. We don't know who's sharing what data, where it's going, how it's being used. And that's the thing. There is no oversight. So it's this kind of blind trust. They're saying, trust me, we're not going to use this against you.
Well, it's not in the abstract, as we know, because we've seen we've been seeing the congressional hearings on the IRS scandal, looking at how people were targeted because of their particular beliefs. And so some of these people were also audited. You had other branches of the federal government, the EPA, going after them. So this information can be shared. It has been shared. We know it's been used incorrectly, wrongly. So it's not just, oh, Big Brother is watching. It's like there are serious issues as to how the government shared this data already.
But one of the issues is actually that because of the massive expansion after 9/11 in spying, the government turned to thousands of private companies to help do this. I think Dana Priest and William Arkin in the Washington Post say that, you know, there are thousands of companies and 1.1 million people in private corporations that are responsible for monitoring and handling private top secret communications and information on people. That's almost one out of 300 Americans is involved in spying on the rest of the country, and that's in private hands. And I think one of the things that makes the assurances of the NSA chief a little bit suspect is that it's all fine for a general in Fort Meade to declare that, you know, he can tell you that no one is listening to this, that, and the other. But the problem is that, you know, as the government has contractors and then subcontractors of subcontractors and subcontractors who are involved in spying. And there's no way that they can tell you that someone who's involved in monitoring communications at a small private subcontractor, let's say in Colorado, isn't doing something untoward. And it's not monitored because it's all off the books. And congressional oversight is weak because it's all off the books. And this is another huge part of the problem, is that it's not only private companies for profit who are involved in this. It's private companies who work for the government with weak monitoring systems that are responsible for doing this.
And I just wanted to make a couple of points in addition, that, you know, this amount of intelligence gathering actually dilutes our ability to really get good intelligence. It's too much information to sift through, and most of it is irrelevant. So it's a huge waste of time of analysts to be sifting through this stuff, and they're missing probably what they should be looking for. But we also need to look at the trends that are starting to happen. You know, we know that drone strikes, where, you know, the president orders the murder of people around the world with drones, is based on behavior. If someone is in a certain place, or they're doing a certain thing, or they're with certain people, they're presumed to be guilty without trial or, you know, investigation. And this amount of data collection, which is looking at our behavior, we've already started to see in the world preemptive arrests based on suspicion that somebody might protest. And there's a case going in California right now by Shell Oil against protesters because they're worried that they want to be able to say to ban them from being able to protest if they have a suspicion that they might protest. So, you know, where is this going? We're kind of on this slippery slope that we need to have a real national dialogue about.
Let me just some of the phones here. We'll come right back, Mark.
Sure.
Okay. 410-319-8888. Join us here on the Mark Steiner Show. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Is Bryce still there? Bryce is hung up. Bryce, we'll call back. We'll get you back on. Let's go to Timothy. You're on the air. Hi, Timothy. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And how are you? And how are the guests doing?
We're all doing well.
Good, thank you.
Good. Thanks.
Yeah. Listen, I want to challenge what the young lady just said, ma'am. You used the word scandal, and you used that these folks were targeted. All right. Just hear my point here, and you understand why I'm saying this.
Go ahead.
Each and every last one of those Tea Party folks who were applied for an application for their what is it, 501(c)(3).
C4.
Were given and granted what they needed to have, what they were requesting.
No, they weren't. They were not granted. Many of them have not yet been granted their 501(c)(4) status.
Well, the information and facts that I received, that they did not deny not one of them.
That's not true.
So I'm going to Google it again, because last time I checked about a week ago, and all of them were given what they were requesting now. That's one of my points. My second point is, where were your voices when the NAACP, when the civil rights leader were being targeted by our government? Where were your voices then? you know, in support of fair treatment of not spying on our citizens.
I think it's wrong to spy on everyone. I mean, Martin Luther King was spied on a regular basis, and it was terrible. I mean, I think this is wrong across the board. I don't support any of that.
So my point is...
Oops. Timothy, you still there?
I think we lost him.
Timothy, let's go to our... You were going to make a point, then we're going to go right to Bryce, who's been holding on for a while.
I was just going to point out here in Maryland, a few years ago, when was it, 05, 06, when you had... the state police infiltrating peace groups, and that was just nuts. But that's the kind of stuff that happens when you have no oversight, when the public does not know what's going on. And these people had, there was no reason that any of these people should have been watched. And actually, the state police were sending reports to the NSA, I mean, for a while on these folks. So, right.
Well, this has been going on for a very long time.
Right.
It's gotten, the technology has made it more intense.
Right.
As the senior person in the group, I will say that, back in the late 60s, early 70s with COINTELPRO, our phones were tapped regularly.
Right. And you had undercover officers.
In every one of our organizations.
All groups, right.
We had, I'll tell you this, then it was kind of almost sloppy. Today, it's not sloppy. I think that's the funny thing. It was sloppy, so sloppy that when we moved our offices at the Washington Free Press in 1969 from one building to the next, we actually had the phone guy come in and he's moving our phone, said, "Do you want us to move your other phone?" And I said,
"What are their phones?"
No. I went, "Sure. Well, which phone do you mean?" He said, "The one in the building in the apartment across the street." I was, "Yeah, move that one too."
That's great.
So we saw them being confronted by the agents as they're moving them out, taking the phone on the street because they had, taken the phone out from across the street. But they've been doing this forever. But now it's even more insidious because technology has made it more insidious. And one of the things that one of the people on the show said a couple of weeks ago as we were covering this was that there's so much information they don't have the technology to use it. Well, that technology is changing all the time. One of the things that you pointed out, Amara, in your article, which shows how technology changes, we were all debating on this program and other programs over years the digital divide. Well, now because of smartphones, a lot of that digital divide gap has been closed because there are more, percentage-wise, people of color in this country with smartphones than white folks because that's the means of communication. So,
right.
I mean, communication technology and how we track that changes all the time, and therein, Amara, lies the danger.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that one of the interesting things that's come out of this is that with the help of Silicon Valley, they do now have a lot of the technology to process this information in terms of metadata. And once again, that's not interested in processing specific pieces of information to use in intelligence. It's used to map who's talking to whom, what are their relationships, who do they know, where do you go, generally trying to figure out what your profile is and what profiles of people are who might be doing things that they think are suspicious. And that's relatively easy to do. If I have all of your electronic communications plus the phone records, I can pretty much map, they have data to be able to map people's lives doing that. And I think that, as you say, we need to realize that the technology is a couple of steps ahead of where we think it is. And that's one of the things that's come out is a lot of the programs that they've developed to be able to sift through large amounts of data quickly.
So let me go right to the phones here again. 410-319-8888. Bryce, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Bryce, you're on the air at last.
Yeah.
Welcome.
My point is that, this vast array of intelligence devices that have cost hundreds of millions of dollars did nothing to prevent the Sarnyev brothers from bombing the Boston Marathon. And in fact, all of the terrorist attacks in this country, including 9/11, have been failures of human intelligence. The FBI had information on the bombers of 9/11, but it was just not communicated up the chain. The Russians let the FBI know that they had concerns about the Sarnyev brothers. They interviewed briefly and let them go. And so it seems to me that we ought to be spending the money, if we were going to spend it on anything, on getting our intelligence services actually up to operating speed.
Yeah, I'm really glad that this caller brought up the cost, because that's something that we haven't talked about is both the expense of this type of system, also the ecological impact of
this. What do you mean ecological impact?
Well, there's a data storage center in Utah, which is supposed to be able to store data for the next 100 years.
Oh, right.
They had to build their own power plant. It uses as much electricity as the city of Salt Lake, you know, Salt Lake City, as well as 1.5 million gallons of water a day to cool, you know, their servers. So this is, you know, this is taking money out of the economy that should be used to build real security, which is education for everyone, healthcare for everyone, good jobs. That's real security, but that money is going into this huge, you know, security state.
Mark, can I defend the security services really quickly on one particular thing? One of the things they're responding to is that we have a zero tolerance for any terrorist attacks. That is to say, no matter what the time span between them, we have an expectation that this is never supposed to happen anymore. And one of the reasons why they're going to these extreme measures is because we as a public are pushing them to, whenever there's attack or something goes wrong, immediately there's a blame game of what didn't you do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And their response is, well, in order for us to be able to meet a zero tolerance thing, that's going to mean that we have to become more intrusive in people's lives. And Washington has seemed to sign off on that, and I think that one of the things that we have to debate is what is going to be our margin here for the trade-off between our liberty and our willingness to accept that we live in a dangerous world.
Well, and
the thing with and specific to Maryland too, the thing that bothers me is that it's good business for Maryland, and so O'Malley's been very happy to, you know, he's been silent on this issue. I wrote an article in the Sun about this recently. He has not come out and said one way or the other what he thinks about this whole situation. And he is he bills himself as this, you know, crusading progressive who is for inclusive, diverse, wants to have, you know, all civil liberties are amazing to him. So what about this? He's been completely silent on this. And because I think it's just, it increases the number of federal workers making over $100,000 in Maryland, and therefore the tax coffers get more money. That's wrong to me.
And then we'll go back right to the phones.
Yeah, go ahead if you want to go to the phone.
410-319-8888. Tyrone, you're on the air. Tyrone, you're on the air.
Yeah, I thought wiretapping or listening in on people's phone calls was a common practice with FBI or local law enforcement.
Right.
Didn't they do it with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King or even nickel and dime drug dealers in the city? Didn't they do that all the time? Yeah. Why such an outcry all of a sudden about this?
I think they had warrants in those cases, though. This is about warrantless, just mass monitoring of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think... go ahead, Mara.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, they had to go to a judge to go up on a wiretap on these. Like, you know, there are lots of questions about that process, but at least there was one. I think the problem is that there is a mass monitoring of tens of millions of people with sweeping authorization from the FISA court. So one order can be the following. You can go to Skype and say, I want all of the communications between everyone in the United States who's contacted anyone in Africa and in the Middle East. And that's one wiretap, but you've just hoovered up, you know, millions of people in that one particular order. And that's what's different.
Yeah, and I love the fact that it was recently revealed that the FISA court has never actually turned anything down. What did Obama say? Well, we wouldn't ask for it if it wasn't worth it. But I think the conversation has got to be about why is it that we live in a dangerous world? What is the U.S. foreign policy doing to create this dangerous world? We're in this vicious cycle right now where our foreign policy is generating more and more anger towards the United States, our exploitation of the planet, exploitation of people, these quagmires of wars that we're getting into. And so are we going to just keep doing that, you know, inflaming the problem and then lock down our own society more? Or do we want to really look at our foreign policy and say, you know, we really need a more diplomatic and cooperative foreign policy?
I mean, part of that, and then the question there is an important question. I think that there have been, though, a lot of people on the show before, former CIA agents who are not on the left necessarily and are not on the right either necessarily, but have said, look, there's a real danger in the world, no matter where it started. I mean, if our foreign policy started it or, you know, those issues have now arisen and American people are in danger at some level, as we've seen in Boston. So their question, though, is, and they're all questioning, is this mega data mining the way to protect America from those immediate threats? And their response is usually no. We should know who we're going to go after, who we're monitoring, why we're monitoring them, so we can figure out who to stop before they do what they do, not kind of collecting data on everybody. But we are, partially, as someone else wrote, partially it's on us because we don't say anything about it. Everything we do, my computer here, every time I log on to this, every time I use my GPS, every time I buy something online, I'm giving them my data. And that's part of the issue.
Well, no, but we do have, we are doing this vast monitoring. We do have these silly procedures like making everyone take your shoes off in the airport that make no sense, that just hold up the line and that do not make us safer. So this is another instance on a much more insidious level of with the data mining of going after things and wasting time focusing on people who have no problem.
We're at the top of the hour. We have to take a quick break. We're going to come right back. We're going to talk about immigration and other issues as well. Stay with us at 410-319-8888 with our national panel. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We have our roundtable of national and international news. This hour, I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com. We are here with Amara Jones, economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com, who served in the Clinton White House, Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of its OurEconomy.us, and co-host of the radio show with Clearing the Fog, Marta Mossberg, columnist for the Baltimore Sun and the Frederick News Post, and you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at SteinerShow at gmail.com, or you can log on to our Facebook pages. I need to check that out, which I'll do in a minute, or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Let me just move to another area real fast with you all. Immigration, which is kind of gripping Congress in its debates. We are now putting a large amount of money in kind of not necessarily immigration reform, but in border security. There'll certainly be enough officers now for one officer for one Border Patrol person for every 1,000 feet. Is that right? Do I have that right?
I'm not sure.
It's something like that. That
it's
I
a
read.
Lot.
A
yeah.
lot. So, and that when we look at the issues of immigration and look at the border, there was a very moving piece I saw the other day about in Nogales, which is a city on both sides of the border in Arizona, that where kids who had not seen their parents or mothers for like 6 to 10 years have been deported, kind of talked to them through these holes in the wall. And so your analysis, Marta Mossberg, let's just start with you, then we'll go around the room.
It was when I lived in North Carolina, I did a series on migrant workers there and followed these guys who were pulling tobacco. And I ended up going back to their town in Michoacan, and there are no men there at all from the age of like 10 to 75, because everyone is in the U.S. and all of them go in legally, but many of them overstay. But it's just, it creates and their families can't stay, so they're sending money back home. But these lives are permanently interrupted, and children are growing up without parents, and it's not a good situation what we've had.
Yeah, it was really striking when Obama was just in Berlin this week after the G8 to make a speech,
right.
And he talked about how great it was that there was no wall there. And meanwhile, we're building this huge wall between the United States and Mexico. It was really ironic. But the immigrants who come here by and large from those types of towns, they don't want to leave their families by choice. It's, again, it boils down to our economic policy, our international economic policy, which puts these countries into poverty and forces people out of desperation to look for places to work. And so that's the discussion that we should be having. Money can move freely across borders. Why can't people move freely across borders?
You have to have a rule of law, though, and it's important that we have a policy in place that makes it possible for people to operate within a legal framework so they're not, I don't think that you can just have a policy that lets people come in and work, but then they can't participate in the system too. So if you want to come to the United States, then there should be a process in order to become a citizen. And you can't. I mean, what we have right now is just all these people operating under the table, and
I think the studies show that the taxes that the immigrant workers pay in this country actually subsidize our public programs. There was just a study showing how much they subsidize our health in this country. If multinational corporations corporations can move their dollars around the world with impunity and take trillions of dollars out of our country, why are we squabbling about people who want to come here for work? And why aren't we talking about the bigger conversation of what our policies do, like these free trade agreements and now the new ones that are being secretly negotiated, the Trans-Pacific Partnership? What's that going to do to, you know, to the Asian countries, Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, you know, driving down our wages globally? These are the things we need to be talking about, not, you know, the smaller problems.
So, well, no, I'm just saying I don't disagree with that. I just think that you need to, you know, if we live in a country with a rule of law, that everyone should be functioning within it. We shouldn't have this whole shadow class of people. And that's why we need to have immigration reform so that we get people on the path to citizenship and full participation in society.
Why don't we start at the top with the corporations and put the rule of law on them first? That's where the money is. That's where the real problem is. We don't apply the rule of law to big finance or these other multinational corporations.
Imara, you want to jump in on this? We'll come right back to Marta before she has to roll.
Yeah, I mean, I think two things. One, immigration is slow to a trickle. This entire conversation is about what to do about the people that are already here. And I think we would do a lot better to focus on the fact that there are, you know, 11 to 13 million people who are here in the United States who contribute to our society, that are a part of our country, and we need to figure out a way to integrate them, and at that, in a way that is legal and transparent and right. And we need to focus on that. And the second thing is that the militarization of the border is just another way for us to feed paranoia, for us to increase violence, and for us to move in the wrong direction. So instead of focusing on militarizing the border, we need to focus on how to work with the people that are already here. And it looks as if this entire conversation could be moot, because if what happened on the agriculture bill is any indication, regardless of what goes on in the Senate in terms of all of the things they're doing there to get out a bill, just the coalition doesn't look like it's existing in the House, and so this is, you know, has a pretty good chance of going down anyway.
Hmm. Marta?
Well, I mean, just to go back to your point about multinational corporations, I mean, I don't think what corporations do to avoid taxes, they're using the law to their favor to do that. So they're not doing anything illegal. It's just that the tax code is ridiculous, and it allows them to do those things. I mean, I would love to have a tax code that is 10 pages long or one page long, you know, so people cannot be able to hire a lobbyist to give them a special tax code to get out of what they're doing. So that I mean,
but the rule of law is not applied to big finance when we even know that they're committing fraud, and we know
Eric Holder
has said that he's not going to prosecute any of the big bankers.
Right.
So, you know, I agree with you that some of this is happening within the law, and it's the big industries, big finance that writes those laws for their interests. But that's where the big impact is going to come from. If we're worried about, you know, money and things like that, that's where we should be focusing, not on what immigration does. And I think that if there is a path to citizenship, and I agree with that, if people want to become citizens, they should be allowed to do that. We need to respect the rights of every single one of these peoples and not make it a two-tier or three-tier or four-tier type of system. We can't have this guest worker program where the workers are treated like slaves, basically, slave labor. They have to have full rights.
So what do you think will be the outcome of this wall? I mean, if this wall gets built, I know what you said, Amara, that when you look at the food bill, which we'll be talking about next Tuesday, the farm bill, and I know that you have to leave right now. You have to roll, don't you?
Yeah, thank you.
It's good to have Marta Mossberg with us. She has another appointment. We had to push this conversation back a little because of breaking news. Good to have you with us, Marta. Marta Mossberg, columnist with Baltimore Sun and Frederick News Post. So what is this? What do you think this wall will mean, though? I mean, the idea of building a wall across the border between Mexico and the United States, is there another way? Let's say your argument was that Marta would be saying, and I'll just be Marta for a moment, that you have to have some laws stopping immigrants from just walking across the border.
But I think that one of the things that, and maybe this is a way to bridge both what Marta and Margaret were saying, is that these immigrants didn't show up out of nowhere. that a lot of them came here for two reasons. One, because the United States, through NAFTA, changed the agricultural rules that made it a lot cheaper for the United States to export agricultural products to Central and South America. That threw millions of people in that part of the world out of work and changed communities. They're suddenly looking for work. At the same time, in the United States, companies and corporations were putting ads in Central and South, I'm sorry, in Central American newspapers, basically telling people to come to the United States to rendezvous at a certain point and to get work. So these two things are actually working together. So our policies have actually helped to create this problem. And so if we want to do something about immigration, we need to promote an economic policy for the hemisphere that works for everybody. And secondly, we need to create a transparent way for the United States to be able to get labor, but in a way, as Margaret said, that respects people's rights and gives them the opportunity to work here without fear and without intimidation and without deprivation. And so if we're able to reform the system along those lines, then I think that we will make a lot of progress. The problem is that that's not a lot of where this is headed, and so we may not actually be solving the problem, but this didn't just drop out of the sky.
Right. I mean, I agree completely with it, what Amara said. And, you know, what if we took these hundreds of millions, I don't even know how much this is going to be spent on this wall and the workers, you know, the security staff to monitor them and all that technology. What if that instead was put into infrastructure in these countries so that they could get out of this poverty cycle and not have to leave their own countries and be able to stay and keep their families intact?
I mean, what they're saying here, that in this morning's, one of the issues in the paper this morning, AP put out, that what you were saying, Amara, though, they're saying that Republicans and Democrats actually had a breakthrough, that they agreed on an extremely expensive, and I'm looking for the numbers, but I haven't found the exact numbers yet, military-style surge, as the objective, quote-unquote, press writes it, to secure the leaky U.S.-Mexican border. We're talking about 20,000 new agents, 18 drones, 350 miles of fencing and wall, and all kinds of fixed and mobile devices to maintain the border. I mean, it was the Democratic Senator Schumer said, boots on the ground, drones in the air is what we want, what we need. Now, this, of course, was the Senate. I know what you're saying. That it's the House. That the way of thing is insane, even more insane, I should say. Not at, more insane. But this is may have some legs in the House as well.
Well, this go ahead, Amara.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem is two things. Is that one, you know, there's a huge lobbying effort on the part of security corporations that have helped to militarize and criminalize the immigration system so that they can make money. They are a large part of this lobbying effort, and so that's one of the things that people should be aware of that's going on. The second thing is that even if they come out of the Senate with a large vote, the problem is that in the House there are Tea Party people who are not really connected to that lobbying game, that are new, that believe that their job is to tear down rather than build up. And so, like on the farm bill, there's a really good chance, I'd say 50-60%, that they're just going to bring the immigration bill down because they don't want any path to citizenship. They don't want anything that changes, that doesn't do anything but just, you know, boots on the ground, shut the border, and drones. And that's part of the problem. And so the politics in the Senate are fine. In the House, they don't look too good. And I think that one of the other thing that we really miss in all of this is that our country benefits. I mean, one of the things that shocks me is how people talk about immigrants as if the United States, that people are coming here to take and not to give. But, you know, anytime we enter into a supermarket, more likely than not, immigrant labor has picked our food, built our houses, take care of our children, build roads, on and on and on. And that's because of choices that we've made in terms of our economy and how we want it to work and how we want things to be at a certain price point. And so, you know, a lot of this conversation is just misplaced, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, it ties the spying that we talked about in the first segment of this and this, you know, security over immigration. It's all about profit for these corporations that get these huge contracts to put in place these scanners in our airports and all these other, you know, the cameras all around the city of Baltimore. I mean, this is what's driving
New York,
it.
It's San not Francisco, really Chicago, Detroit, and every city in America.
It's not really security. It's the bottom line is profits. And I don't see our Congress at this point as being able to respond effectively to the crises that we're facing in this country, and it's really up to the people, and that's why our new project is popularresistance.org is tying together all of these movements that are actually happening in this country and around the world of people who do want to live just and peaceful and sustainable lives.
410-319-8888. Join us here on our News Roundup with our guests. Your thoughts and ideas are welcome. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Or you can just tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Let me shift gears for a moment. This is something that we see creeping in here, and Adil Shamu, who's an often guest on the show, wrote a piece in the Huffington Post just yesterday, who's with Foreign Policy and Focus, and he wrote this piece on the brink of another war. And when we look at Syria and what is going on in Syria, and I think that it's so, as we've talked about with people here before, Syria is a very complex place. And as I tried to say when we were talking about what created our enemies in the Middle East, Margaret, as you were mentioning earlier, that, you know, the regimes like Assad's, regimes like Hussein's or Mubarak or Nasser before him and the others we could mention, the contradictions in those regimes were that while they were authoritarian dictators and did put people in jail and tortured folks without question, the secular world around in the Arab world gathered around those regimes, not in full but in part, because women had more rights, that minorities had rights, like Christians and Alawites and other Muslim minorities had rights. And there's this battle that pits them against a mixture of people who want a democracy in Syria and those who would put in, would reinstitute an Islamic State with Al-Qaeda. It's a very complex situation, and also all built around the oil pipelines that flow through Syria to get to Lebanon and the Mediterranean. This is a complex thing that we're facing, and we're seeing the potential of U.S. involvement on one side or the other.
Well, the U.S. has already been very involved. I mean, this is, you know, it's interesting because we're so, you know, we do what interests the United States. And it's, you know, if it's in Bahrain that these things are happening, it's fine. You know, but if it's in Syria where we want to have more control, then we use our secret forces and our friends in Saudi Arabia to help, you know, fuel this division within the country and get us into another quagmire like Iraq. Syria is going to be, you know, Obama's Iraq if we go forward.
And Amar, I'm really curious as to your thoughts on both in terms of your as a journalist and an analyst, but also, even though this wasn't your area, you were on the inside of that world for a while in the Clinton White House. I'm curious to see your thoughts on how this works.
I mean, a couple of things. I mean, I think Syria is one of the areas where I probably part ways from where people think my orientation would be. I think that actually one of the interesting things about Syria is that not getting involved, our absence has actually helped to make the situation worse. And that's because if you look at a map, Syria is the crossroads of where a lot of key U.S. interests meet. And regardless of what we think the politics of our involvement is, the reality is that for the past 80 years, the United States has been the center of gravity for stability there. And that cuts both ways. I'm not going to make an argument that it's been the right type of stability, but it's been stable. One of the problems and one of the most interesting things is that in the Middle East, there are three kind of nightmare scenarios that the government has. One is a war with Iran. The second is the collapse of the House of Saud. And the third is the disintegration of Syria. And the where things are in Syria now, one in three look like they could be on a collision course. And so I think that one of the things is that we have to actually be actively engaged and managed it, and that just staying back and looking the other way has actually helped the problem to fester. And so I think we actually do need to have a robust response. I think it has to look like Bosnia, where we combine military, diplomatic, and humanitarian in a really focused and dramatic way. This is not where anybody wants to be, and this is not an optimal scenario for the United States and where we are and what we want to do going forward. But it is, if you look at where we are, just a real politique, I would argue, necessity. And I think that it's tragic because we need, you know, Afghanistan is the culmination. Where we are in Afghanistan is the culmination of all the bad choices that we've made for the past 30 years and even the past 10 years. Everything that's gone wrong is what we're reaping now, which is one of the reasons why it probably won't go well and probably why we need to come out and reassess. But we can't leave totally because that will also be a mess. So the problem with how the world that we build in the Middle East is we've helped to construct a reality where there are not a lot of good choices, but where one choice we can't have is to not be involved. And that's sad.
It almost sounds to me like you're defending humanitarian war, which is this whole concept that's been put out there now that progressives are buying, that we're going to war because it's better for the people whose country we're destroying and who we are killing. And this is wrong. War is wrong. The United States has been feeding weapons to the rebels in Syria for a long time. We've not been standing back and being not part of this. We're actually fueling it. The United States has not won a major conflict since World War II. We're the largest military in the world, the wealthiest country in the world, and we don't win these situations. We've got to stop going to war and thinking of that as a tool.
One of the interesting things is that I actually don't believe in humanitarian war or humanitarian progressivism. On certain areas like this, I'm actually much more realpolitik, unfortunately, and I don't like the fact that I feel like I have to be that way. But I'm much more realpolitik, and that is to say that this is a disaster, and it's a strategic disaster for the United States and the world, in part because not that we haven't been there on the margins, but we haven't actively participated and helped to manage the situation, which is what U.S. involvement in the Middle East is about. So, for example, the negotiations that we had that we helped broker between the Palestinians and the Israelis wasn't necessarily about promoting a peace. It was actually about keeping a lid on the problem through dialogue. And that's one of the things that in this part of the world, in these really acute problems, I believe that it's actually realpolitik in terms of how do we just keep things from totally sliding off the rails in a nightmare scenario, and that's kind of where we are in Syria. This is not about anything that's hopeful or light. It's actually a series of bad choices, and which one do you have to make?
So why aren't we doing the same thing in Bahrain, where they're, imprisoning health professionals and others?
What's going on in Bahrain is not a key strategic interest to the United States, Saudi Arabia.
But it is, though, because one of the reasons we're not saying anything in Bahrain is because that's where we have our biggest base.
Of course.
That's what we need Bahrain in terms of the American strategic policy. So we say it's okay to torture people in Bahrain, but it's not okay to torture people in Egypt or in
Syria. Right, that's why people need to know that what this is actually about. And this is about, again, it all ties down to who does the military serve? It serves the large multinational corporations who want to get the resources cheaply, who want to get labor cheaply, who want to get oil and pipelines. We're, a country that uses many times more resources per person than any other country in the world and wastes so much. And so what we have to understand, the cost of our lifestyle, the cost of the American way of life, is exploitation of people, human rights abuses, and murder of people around the world. And when do we start changing as a society? It's happening in a lot of ways. People are starting to create alternative institutions outside of this current.
So let me ask this question, Margaret, in terms of what Mara was saying, which you've just been saying. Let's say, for argument's sake, American policy from the beginning should have been not to be on Assad's side or not to be on Assad's side. But, we have let me go to the call, phone too. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Hi, Clarence, you're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Stein.
Welcome.
I'd just like to ask you a question. What are the Russians' interests in there? Are these opposing interests to the U.S. or... do you see this as Putin versus Obama? Thank you.
Great.
Well, the only Russian foreign military base is in Syria. And so, of course, it was great. To me, it was amusing to see the photo out of the G8 where Putin and Obama were in the same room and had to be interviewed. They looked like two boys who did not want to be. They'd rather be anywhere else.
In the principal's office.
Exactly. this is a huge point of contention between Russia and the U.S. And again, we're trying to use our might to manipulate the world, really. And we need to stop doing that.
I mean, the issue also here is that no matter what the United States does or doesn't do, they can't control what's happening in Egypt. The Egyptian military is still in charge. And what's going to happen in Syria is going to affect that entire region. And I think that problem is that America doesn't know what to do, doesn't have a clue.
Gee, what's is that new?
how to address this issue.
Just like Afghanistan.
I'll find them far from a listener here. Verna, you're on the air. Hi, Verna, you're on the air.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning.
I would like to address your guest, Ms. Margaret Flowers, who I haven't heard such truth from in such a long time. Yes, hello.
Hello. Hello. You're on the air.
I am calling, again, to collaborate many of the things that she says. One thing I'd like to strike out on, first of all, is the United States supportment of Israel, which is nothing less than supporting of apartheid.
Yes.
Supporting of genocide.
Yes.
Which they claim they're against. Now, the same thing was repeated already in South Africa for years.
Mm-hmm.
For years and years and years. And all the rebellion against it was suppressed, and we all know what happened to poor Nelson Mandela. Well, you know, the whole thing is that they had the same tactics going forever. It's conquer and divide. And I hate to say it, but it's just the truth. Most of all the people in the world, they want to conquer and divide, as usual, are dark people who populate the world way far in numbers than Caucasian people do. Mrs. Steiner, I'm sorry that you know, I hope I'm not insulting you. I don't mean to insult you, but it's just the honest truth.
You're not insulting me.
You're not insulting me. I'm with you, Verna.
And I'm bigger than you. I have a bigger gun, so you say what I want to say. It's not about justice. It's not about the American way. It's about I say you and you do it because I'm white and right.
Thank you so much, Verna, for your thought. And I think that's the final thought for the moment for today. I want to thank all of our guests. Amara Marsberger was here earlier. Amara Jones, economic justice contributor for Call Lines. Always great to have you with us, Amara. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of It's Our Economy.us, co-host of Clearing the Fog. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And we'll be attaching all their work here at steinershow.org and our website. We'll take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to be with Dr. Lawrence Brown here from Morgan State University and Judy Lombardi talking about gentrification and the displacement of poor people in Baltimore, a really interesting piece that was written in Indie Reader by Dr. Lawrence Brown. So we wanted to have him join us to talk about that. Stay with us. We'll be right back.